We'll reconvene the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation. We have a little bit of an agenda to get through. We have to adopt rules?
Oh, no, we won't do the rules today, Mr. Chair. We will adopt them at our next meeting.
Oh, thanks. Okay, let's take that out. It's an informational meeting only.
We're just right down here.
And so we're going to hear from Paul Mather, Dave Kavanaugh, and Travis Brower.
Mm-hmm.
If I bombed anybody's name, I apologize.
Just right.
Having a name Gerard, I'm used to people mispronouncing it, so...
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Now, you do have the two most important people of the community here, so.
There's two people that care.
So, good morning, Travis and I. First, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. Travis Brower and I are going to walk you through this. We're going to try to cover a couple of things here. I'm going to first start out by just giving you a tour of some of the things ODOT's been up to this summer and some of our major projects, and just quickly walk through kind of the status of some of those. And then Travis and I are going to get into talking about some of the revenue and some of the forecasts of those revenues, both on the state side and the federal side, to kind of draw a picture for you of financially where the highway fund at the federal level and the state level sit. So I'm going to start just walking through a series of projects around the state and just give you a little bit of update on how those are going. Starting in western Washington County here on Highway 26 Sunset Highway at Brookwood. This is a key project for all the economic growth development that's happening and is projected to happen in western Washington County. This revision to the Brookwood interchange will be key to sustain that growth in that area. This is a project that's just getting underway. It's a $48 million project funded from the Jobs and Transportation Act. Wildish Standard Paving is a contractor out of Eugene. We're planning a formal groundbreaking for later this month, but the contractor is actually out there doing some work now. That will continue to ramp up. We should have this open to traffic by next fall. We'll have some work happening the following spring, but we should be close to next fall, this time next year, to open this to traffic. Sunrise Corridor, another key project from an economic standpoint. There are many, a very large industrial area here, but many large regional distribution centers, including Safeway and Fred Meyer's in this area. This is a segment of the overall Sunrise Corridor project. It's a $130 million project. About $100 million of that comes from the Jobs and Transportation Act. Kerr Contractors from Woodburn is the prime contractor on this. We let this project last spring, had a groundbreaking earlier this year, and the contractor is well underway in doing work.
And that project's in a very important Senate district too, right?
Extremely important, Mr. Vice Chair. Yes,
right.
Yes, extremely important district of the state. Some of the colors just on that chart there just to indicate some of the phasing as well as how we're supporting the main. Project. The large blue line going through the center of the screen there is the Sunrise Corridor, kind of an extension of the Milwaukee Expressway, bypassing some of that congestion around the 205 interchange, and then just some of the local support networks that we're going to be building to support traffic circulation to keep that economic engine of that part of the state functioning. Just a quick picture of some of the work that's been going on. If you've been driving down 205, you see some of the work going on in the median to start the bridge work for the new overcrossing. That this one will actually support 82nd Drive and its new connection. Highway 20 project, Pioneer Mountain to Eddyville. I've given you a couple updates on this project. As you recall, I think the last time I was here, I was talking about us taking over the project. We had a settlement agreement with the prior contractor on this project, and we've done some work, some minimal work last summer, but really aggressive work this summer on the project. I don't have a pointer, but the dashed blue line shows the new alignment. Much of that new alignment is complete, where you see it there kind of in the foreground paralleling the existing route. All that is complete, and a segment in the far end of the project is also complete. The part of the project we struggle with is really in the center, kind of the new alignment piece there in the center is where we've had some very large landslides. We are transitioning the project from one that is based on bridges going over many of those large ravines to one of culverts and fills. It's a much less risky approach. Bridges and a very slight movement of those landslides can cause significant problems, which we've found. And so that the fills that we're transitioning to are much more tolerant of minor movements of the ground underneath.
You might hit it, but you know, we were over budget quite a bit on this project, and you came in and asked for addition, you know, the approval to go on. How is it? Are we going to be within the new projections?
Mr. Chair, things are tracking very well for us. We're continuing to monitor the groundwater, which are going to be critical design factors in how much more mitigation we have to do for those landslides. So far, we're seeing our cost estimates and the bids we got on the contract for the summer come in at or below what we projected. So things are tracking well. We're going to know a lot next spring when the major part of the project will go out to bid. We're in the final stages of design of that now. We're going to have a presentation to our commission later this fall updating them on that contract, and early next spring we'll have that out for bid. K&E Contractors out of Salem is doing the work this summer as they lay the culverts and begin to build some of the fills around each of those ravines. Here's a shot of some of the work and the large culverts that are building. This is a very complex project with many different work sites. This is a site representing probably less than 20% of the project. There's complex, multiple things happening simultaneously in this project. You have about a three-month work window in the Coast Range to do this type of work, and so the contractor takes a very aggressive approach in the work that we have on this project.
What is your time frame for completion of this project now?
Mr. Chair, we're projected to have open to traffic in 2016. So that remains the same, and our cost numbers are remaining the same from the last time I was talking to you. Another large project that we're managing is the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass. This is a segment of that bypass that we're building that bypasses just the Dundee and Newburgh section of the highway. There's major congestion in this area virtually every day, but it's particularly on the weekend traffic as they travel this corridor to and from the coast. But this would provide relief for the communities of Newburgh and Dundee. This is a roughly a $250 million contract. $192 million of that is jobs and transportation funds. We've divided this project into four different contracts, trying to stir competition and make Oregon firms competitive for the work. The latest contract that we have is for Leduc Contractors from Talent, Oregon, is doing the work this summer. We have the major portion of this project also will be let next spring, or we'll be doing the major bridge and road work. But Leduc Contractors been working this summer and laying some of the foundation work, again, the culverts. One of the other pieces of work they're doing is putting in wick drains or draining the subgrade to stabilize that for the roadbed to be built on top of that. So they've been working on that this summer. This project is also projected to be open to traffic in 2016.
Another question. Do we have anything on the table that is going to connect like Newburgh or McMinnville to the I-5 corridor a lot more direct than what it is now? Because I've traveled that before. You either got to go through Woodburn or you go up through Wilsonville, or it's just kind of a mess in through there. Is there any connection between I-5 on the table at all for that region?
Mr. Chair, there is nothing in the planning or construction stages, or I should say the design or construction stages, but there's been conversations by the communities, by the county. If you remember, there was a bill this last session for a public-private partnership to construct a road through that area. So there's been conversations about that, but there isn't anything concrete. Okay. moving forward. Wyoming River Bridge in Eugene has been a very successful project for us. This is a $200 million replacement of the I-5 bridges in the communities of Eugene and Springfield. It is really the signature project of the OTIA 3 bridge program. As we wrap that program up, it's a $1.3 billion program, over 300 bridges that we've addressed over a 10-year period. The overall program has come in under budget. And on time, this particular bridge is open to traffic about 4 months earlier than we projected, and it's been a great success in the community. ODOT's had its challenges over the years in building projects in the Eugene-Springfield area. This project has been very successful in working with the communities on the design and the construction and the staging of the project. In fact, this last summer we had a couple of ceremonies commemorating the completion of the bridge and really celebrating our success with the community. We had dignitaries there for a formal ceremony, and then we had a Saturday or Sunday afternoon that we actually opened the bridge to the public just to go up, ride their bikes, enjoy the bridge before we opened the traffic, which was very successful for the community. So it's really the signature project that really kind of crowns and finishes out the OTIA 3 bridge program. Also in Eugene-Springfield area, we continue to work on the I-5 Beltline project. This particular project does what we call Unit 3, or improves the on and off ramps in that northwest quadrant of the interchange, as well as provide a bike path in the area. This project is support the development that we're happening in the Gateway area, specifically the McKinsey-Willamette Hospital that's there, and the other development that's happening in that Gateway area. Here's a shot of some of the work that's going on this summer. This is also a project that K&E Contractors out of Salem is doing. It is funded by the Jobs and Transportation Act, about a $30 million project in this area. And you can see some of the ramp improvements that we're making there, and some of the work that K&E is doing this summer. Woodburn Interchange, a very congested interchange that's been really needed some improvements for a long time. And so we've been working on a design with the community. We had a nice groundbreaking ceremony again earlier this summer to kick this project off. It's a JTA project, or mostly funded from Jobs and Transportation Fund. The total cost of the project is $80 million. About $53 million of that is coming from the Jobs and Transportation Act. K&E Contractors out of Salem is also the contractor on this project. Here's a picture of the groundbreaking ceremony that we had earlier this summer. One of the major features, besides the congestion relief that we're doing at the interchange, is building a transit center in one of the quadrants of the interchange. This will be a great place for some of the regional providers and the local providers of transit to make a connection right there on I-5, and that's where some of the work has begun. Here's a shot of some of the work around the interchange and some of the ramps improvements that is already underway this summer. This project should be open to traffic in 2015, but will be a very challenging project just given the congestion that's already there, and now we're adding a construction project right in the middle of a very congested interchange. Will provide some challenges for us, certainly, as we move through the next couple summers to complete this project.
When you're completed, how much of the traffic problem is going to be taken care of? Because we talk about it being congested. It's beyond congested.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the design will solve the everyday problems and some of the more severe problems, but it won't solve the day after Thanksgiving type of crowds that you see headed for the outlet mall. So you'll still have those very pronounced, they're very peaked congestion ones that we'll still see some congestion here. But what you won't see are the everyday congestion that you see on a daily or weekly basis at the interchange. Moving to the south, another Jobs and Transportation Act project. This is a climbing lane project that we've actually combined with one of our pavement preservation projects. We had a pavement preservation project doing a segment of the freeway, and we added the Jobs and Transportation Act climbing lane to this. This is just north of Grants Pass, so if you're familiar with the area, it's Sexton Mountain Pass, that's just north of Grants Pass, south of Canyonville area, where this project is. The climbing lane will be northbound, and you see a little bit of a shot of a picture in there of some of the work that's going on. Here's a little closer look at the work that's going on in the project. This is a $35 million total project cost. That includes our maintenance for our preservation overlay. $10 million of that is from the Jobs and Transportation Act to build a specific climbing lane. Knife River out of Medford is the contractor. If you've experienced some of the climbing lane problems and congestions that we have very slow moving truck traffic, you know, going up sometimes up the shoulders of these roads, traveling 5-10 miles an hour, and then traffic trying to pass going 65 miles an hour really creates a differential and some safety operational issues. And this, obviously, the passing lanes will provide a truck to separate those two different speeds. One of the things I will note also on this project, if you remember last session, we had some testimony from Knife River. Brian Gray was here, president of their company, talking about some of the safety issues they have working in the freeway, working in specific sites. Unfortunately, on this project earlier this summer, Knife River had one of their employees that was killed on this project. What appears to be a distracted driver struck a piece of equipment, pushing it over the top of the guardrail and striking one of their employees. So it was an unfortunate incident, but I think raises the just the awareness and the dangers that happen in some of these work zones that we have. Turning to Central Oregon, the Murphy Road project on US 97, this is on the south end of Bend. If you're familiar with the Bend Parkway, most of the parkway has grade-separated intersections until you get to the south end. There's a couple traffic signals on the south end. This is a project to eliminate the signals and the connection there at the very south end of the project. So if you're familiar where Bend Parkway takes off, this takes that traffic signal out and provides a grade separation there, and also provides another separation for what's called Murphy Road that crosses over. So we have construction, again, just beginning on this project. The total project cost is $45 million. $25 million is the Jobs and Transportation Act. Hamilton Construction out of Springfield is the contractor, and projected opening of this is 2014. There's some work of some of the overcrossing work going on in the median to create the beginnings of the bridge, to create the overcrossing. Some of the subcontracting work going on with some of the paving on some of those side streets. The last project I was going to talk about is Eastern Oregon, just out of the Grand. We have a truck climbing lane that's funded out of the Jobs and Transportation Act. We've combined with one of our pavement preservation and bridge preservation projects just from an efficiency standpoint. The total project cost here is about $40 million. The climbing lane itself, which is funded from the Jobs and Transportation Act, is $5.7 million. Oregon Mainline Paving is the contractor for this project. We're estimated to complete it by 2015. It's a fairly complex project, and again, you're working in a snow zone area that you have pretty limited construction windows to work in. Like on the Sexton Mountain project, there's truck capacity or safety issues as those trucks either chain up or move up the roadway, and the speed differentials between the trucks and the cars is really a safety operational issue that this project will solve. Good. So from there, I'll ask David Cavanaugh, our state economist, to come up and kind of walk you through. Mr. Chair, maybe I'll pause there. Is there any questions you have on any of those projects before we transition into the revenue piece?
Okay. Those projects, I don't. I just kind of want to get some projects on the chalkboard. Sisters, the bypass and Sisters. Sisters is a nightmare, especially during high peak tourist areas. Is there anything on the chalkboard at all to do to improve that bypass that goes through Sisters?
Mr. Chair, actually, there are several things going on as we work with the community on that issue. First, we have a project that actually is under construction, and you'll really see the major parts of the construction happening early next spring, which will rebuild the entire downtown section. Our goal is to start that work as early as possible in the spring and have it completed before about the July 4th weekend, and have a fairly intensive construction period happening in that downtown area during next spring. There's also conversations about that bypass that you speak about and making better connections on either end of that bypass.
Even a light would be nice.
Well, that's part of the conversation. There's conversations about having roundabout connections or traffic signal connections, and we're working with the community to sort those out and then figure out some funding plans of how we do that. So that's an active conversation that we're having with the community.
Well, okay, we've spent money on a lot of money on the Highway 20 project. Is there any, that goes from the coast to Corvallis? Is there anything that's looking from Corvallis to Bend or Salem to Bend to improve access between Bend and the valley? Are we looking at, because really the number of passing lanes just seem totally inadequate on 22 and 20 is just curvy as all get out, and then I'm not sure the number that goes down to Eugene, but those three roads.
Mr. Chair, we don't have anything certainly on the scale that we have for the Pioneer Mountain project.
Okay.
We have some minor operational projects that are planned in those areas, but nothing of the scale where we would, you know, straighten out or improve several miles at a time of those highways.
Okay. And the final one is, are we looking at anything to cure the Lincoln City problem? Because Lincoln City is a nightmare, because you got the Portland traffic, Salem traffic, and then it just gets tied up in Lincoln City. So, you know, there's, I think it's East D Lake. I mean, there's a there's a kind of a roundabout through Lincoln City too. Are we looking at anything to fix that congestion area?
So, Mr. Chair, similar to the sisters' conversation, we have a construction project that's coming up. It's either next summer or the following summer. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but there is some improvements planned south of the D River, towards the south end of Lincoln City, to make some improvements in an area where it's only a two-lane section to widen that out. And then there's ongoing conversations just with the community about that particular problem and how do you balance the needs of the businesses and the community to thrive along 101, and then the need to provide, you know, traffic and move traffic through Lincoln City. And that finding that balance is a similar conversation to sisters in trying to find a balance between the highway needs and the through needs, as well as what the community needs are.
Any questions? Hey, thanks so much.
Good. So we'll transition.
Go ahead.
David Cavanaugh, our state transportation economist, will kind of walk you through.
Mr. Cavanaugh?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Cavanaugh, state transportation economist for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'd like to just give you a brief overview of our current revenue forecast and some of the components of it. We refer to this as the other funds forecast because these are not general funds revenues. These are revenues that are collected from transportation-related fees and taxes that are paid within the state of Oregon. And by virtue of that, that means that we're not encompassing or incorporating federal funds. That'll be discussed a little bit later with Mr. Brower. So these are just strictly revenues that are generated from fees and taxes in Oregon. The biennium revenue generation is on about the order of $2.3 to $2.4 billion per year. But that somewhat overstates the resource base that's available to the agency for doing the maintenance and repair and enhancement of the state highway network. Once we account for collection costs, which you can see in the chart represents about $402 million, as well as interagency transfers and dedicated program transfers are also in that component. But we also share or apportion a great deal of the revenues, nearly 40%, with the county and city governments after collection costs and program costs are taken out. So in the net, the resource base available to the agency is comprised of the State Highway Fund of $798 million, plus the portion of the State Highway Fund net revenues that go to support debt service. That totals about $1.15 billion. Or a little bit less than half of the gross revenue. So that kind of gives you an idea of by peeling the onion, so to speak, as to what's really available as the resource base for the agencies. What are the assumptions in the forecast? Our current forecast, June 2013, is linked with the state economic forecast from June of 2013. So there's been one forecast released by the State Office of Economic Analysis since then. That was at the end of August. That updated forecast isn't incorporated here, but there are no material differences between the June and the September one, so it wouldn't be expected to have much of an impact on the State Highway Fund forecast, which we only do semi-annually. We don't do it quarterly, so there's a little bit of a kind of a staggering effect there. What are the major sources of the revenue components? The next slide gives a view as to what generates the revenues at a fairly aggregate level. You can see that motor fuels taxes comprise about 45% of the gross revenues. This is before apportionments and collection costs. These are gas and diesel taxes paid by passenger vehicles and vehicles up to a gross vehicle weight of 26,000 pounds. Vehicles, namely trucks, that are in excess of 26,000 pounds pay a weight mile or a weight distance tax, and that's based on how far they drive, their tractor-trailer configuration, axle configurations, and things of that nature. The third major source are vehicle license fees. These are passenger vehicle registration fees, as well as truck registration fees, as well as registration fees for such items as trailers. That comprises about 20% of the total, $2.3 billion. Other transportation license and fees, the bulk of this is made up of title transactions. These would be transactions related to buying a new car in the state of Oregon. It would be related to new title transactions for cars that are coming in migration, where the car is obviously an existing car, but not a new transaction, but they're bringing it in to go ahead and register a title. And then also title transfers for secondary transactions, namely used cars, which would be a big volume of title revenues. There's also a business regulation component where the agency regulates dealers, for example, in salvage yard operations and wreckers. That's a kind of a compliance function to make sure that business is conducted in an ethical fashion. That generates revenue, and that falls within this component. And then the final component, nearly 3% are driver's license fees. These are commercial driver's license fees, tests that the commercial drivers have to take to go ahead and pass safety tests. It's also for individual driver's licenses, generate that $69 million. Another way of classifying our revenues is by how demands are placed on the highway network. And this relates to the user taxes that are generated. That's based on how intensively the highway network and road network is used within the state. And these are comprised of the motor fuel taxes and the weight mile taxes. So as those vary, the user tax, what you pay to use the system, will vary. The other component, vehicle driver and other fees, is basically an access generator. It's not related to how much or how intensively the system is used. So, for example, a driver's license privilege gives the individual legal access to drive on the state highway network, but that fee and that revenue doesn't vary by how much he actually drives on the system. How much he actually drives will go ahead and generate fuel tax revenues, and then he would pay proportionally to how much he uses the system. So this is considered somewhat ideal to not have so much based on access charges and very little on usage charges. Our system of fees and taxes balances them somewhat, and basically in portion to how the costs are really imposed on the system, usage wear and tear, if you will, versus capacity or access demand. What's the outlook based once we take into account collection costs and program costs and apportionments to the local counties and cities? What is our ability to our capacity, if you will, to service our indebtedness? This chart goes ahead and basically for the biennium 2013-15, there's the $798 million in net revenues to the State Highway Fund for that biennium, in excess of the $360 million for the biennium in debt service. And the takeaway from this is basically our coverage ratio, the ratio of total revenues, which is the net revenues, the $1.15 billion, to our debt service is in a very healthy range of 3 to 4 times coverage, debt service coverage. That helps us and enables us to get good bond ratings from the three bond rating agencies that we give to go ahead and evaluate our credit worthiness, and it puts us in strong financial health, and by virtue of that confers benefits in minimizing our interest costs on our debt. Finally, our current outlook, revenue outlook, you can see the red line portrays our current forecast, the June 2013 forecast, and it's juxtaposed with what we were forecasting in 2009. And that was the first forecast after HB 2001 was passed, the Jobs and Transportation Act, which was a major funding initiative on behalf of the agency. And the takeaway from this is that you can see there's been some erosion where we are now from where we thought we were going to be now in 2009. And it's actually fairly significant. The annual shortfalls on a fiscal year basis are in excess of $100 million from what we thought we were going to be getting in 2015 that have actually turned out. The principal culprits to this are basically the recovery has been tepid, if not really very sluggish, and the timing of the recovery keeps getting deferred out into the future. 3 years ago, we thought we'd be on a full employment growth trajectory by 2013, and as everyone knows from reading the headlines, we're not there yet. So that's what's caused the revenue erosion. It's basically cumulatively in the forecast about $508 million over that four-year period that we're short from what we thought we were going to be getting in 2009. So it's a considerable shortfall, but importantly, projects are still getting delivered in a timely fashion.
I have a question for you. You know, the trends towards electric cars, hybrids, my wife just bought a Beetle that gets 40 miles to the gallon. So, I mean, how do you calculate that into your projections, the mileage differential, and also how it relates to the price of gas at the pump, because that actually comes into play, too, in a very volatile world where, you know, one war can jack up the price of gas a buck. So it seems to me like it's kind of, I can understand why you're having trouble with being accurate with projections, but how do you do that?
Mr. Chair, good question. First, on the fuel efficiency of the vehicle fleet, sure enough, the vehicle fleet is becoming more and more fuel efficient. But the new model year cars that are coming out are very fuel efficient, but there is a vast fleet of light passenger vehicles, a stock, if you will, that goes back on the average age of which is 12 years old. People are keeping cars longer. And those vehicles aren't quite as fuel efficient as the new ones. So in our model, the forecasting model, we have an indicator that tracks the entire fuel efficiency of the fleet, and that is in the forecast model. When you put all these things together, new car sales plus existing fleet together, the efficiency of the light vehicle fleet changes just very, very slowly, generally on the order of maybe only 2% a year, and if the average fuel efficiency of the fleet, light passenger vehicles, of course, is only about 21 miles per gallon, that's going back all the vintage cars and whatnot, it just changes very slowly. So the new cars are more fuel efficient. They do have an impact, but it gets really diluted once we go ahead and explain that fuel gets used by the entire fleet of vehicles, not just the brand new ones that are coming off of the showroom. Now, you have to help me. You had two parts to the question.
Well, the second one was with the price of gas, given the volatility of the world.
Yes, good question. Fuel prices are in the forecasting model as well in a very kind of exotic way in terms of saying that, well, people will respond to fuel price increases in the short run, and they'll also respond to it in the long run. In the short run, they'll change their short-term driving habits, maybe even their mode selection. They may go ahead and use public transit a little bit more because fuel prices are really crimping the household budget, and they need to go ahead and economize. In the long run, when it comes time to purchase a new car or another car, they may look at something that's a little bit more fuel efficient and buy that vehicle. So those are the short run and the long run price effects. Those are captured in the forecasting model. But the important thing about fuel prices is to recognize that travel demand is basically a derived demand. People don't go ahead and buy gasoline to just consume gasoline for itself. They buy gasoline as an intermediate input into helping them go ahead and go to work, go to school, go and do recreation. So when it's a derived demand type of a commodity, gasoline like that, it's basically very insensitive to prices in the short run. What we call the price elasticity of demand is fairly low. Unlike actually buying new cars, the price elasticity of new cars is many orders of magnitude higher than the price elasticity for fuel use, because fuel use is a derived demand. Car demand is a little bit different than being derived.
Do you have any questions?
No.
Good.
Good. Yeah, Mr. Chair, we're going to transfer next to the federal side. Travis Brower will come up and kind of walk you through the federal side of this equation.
Chair Dry, Vice Chair Thompson. For the record, I'm Travis Brower, ODOT's Federal Affairs Advisor, and I am here to give you the good and not so good news about federal highway funding. Rarely is it real good news, but I will start with the good news today and cover that pretty quickly, because there isn't as much as there is bad news. If there are two words to remember from the presentation I gave you today, it's uncertainty and risk. We have significant uncertainty and risk clouding our future when it comes to federal transportation funding. Uncertainty about what will happen with federal surface transportation funding, and significant risk that it will be cut substantially as we go forward. So the good news, as I mentioned, federal surface transportation funding plays a really important role in Oregon's transportation system in paying for capital projects that preserve and improve the transportation system. And in recent years, it's been relatively robust. In 2013, so this current federal fiscal year, Oregon will receive well over $500 million for highway transit and safety programs and projects. That's because last year, after a three-year delay in passing a surface transportation bill, Congress passed Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century, or MAP 21, which provided stable funding for highways, transit, and safety programs for 2 years, 2013 and 2014. Those are the federal fiscal years. And it did so at levels relatively comparable to recent years, although it was a little bit below the high that we've seen in 2010 and 2011, but it was a heck of a lot better than the one-third cut that the House of Representatives in particular had been pushing for a period of time when they started writing MAP 21. I've been saying that when it comes to federal funding, flat is the new up, and in this case, a slight cut is the new flat. So we were very happy when MAP 21 came through last year and provided essentially flat funding for transportation. However, so this is where I transition to the bad news. The Federal Highway Trust Fund faces its own fiscal cliff next year when it exhausts its balances yet again. Because the federal gas tax hasn't been raised since 1993, revenue into the Highway Trust Fund has lagged behind spending, because the gas tax is one of the few taxes that does not increase in any way with inflation. And in fact, it's actually eroded by inflation, as you can imagine. The Highway Trust Fund has been significantly hurt by the recession, which has caused user fee revenues to drop. And in addition, the high gas prices and the reduced amount of driving we've seen in the face of that, increasingly fuel-efficient vehicles, which you just discussed, have also taken some bites out of federal revenues. So as a result, you can see from this chart, the Highway Trust Fund has been running a deficit between user fees and the amount of money that Congress has provided over the last few years, and that will continue into the future. This is a structural deficit, not just a short-term deficit. So to avoid cutting transportation spending, since 2008, Congress has transferred a total of $54 billion in general fund resources into the Highway Trust Fund. They've done that rather than dealing with the long-term issues by raising user fees or finding some other source. So they have not really provided the long-term, sustainable, adequate funding. Instead, MAP 21 just punted the issue 2 years down the road, got us through 2013 and 2014 with flat funding by transferring more than $20 billion into the Highway Trust Fund from some very interesting sources like LUST, otherwise known as the Leaking Underground Storage Tank Fund. Some of that money was put in the Highway Trust Fund. Money from Roll Your Own Cigarette Taxation was put in the Highway Trust Fund. So a whole series of what they call the federal level pay-fors were used to put into the Highway Trust Fund. However, MAP 21 expires in 379 days and 14 hours, not that anybody's counting, at the end of September 2014. And at about the same time, the Highway Trust Fund will once again have burned through its remaining balances and dip into negative territories. And by 2015 and beyond, it will be suffering an annual deficit of about $15 billion per year. So you can see there in the green line, the balances in the Highway Trust Fund next year will dip below zero. Technically, the Highway Trust Fund can't actually run a deficit. So that will lead to some pretty significant consequences with the Federal Surface Transportation Program. Because it can't run a deficit, Congress has three ways of dealing with a Highway Trust Fund deficit. First, it could cut funding by about 30%. It could raise user fees or other taxes to make up the difference. This would be equivalent to about a gas tax increase of somewhere in the range of 8 to 10 cents per gallon. Or it could provide about $15 billion in general fund resources each year into the future. But if Congress does nothing, the one-third, 30% cut in transportation funding is what would happen. And I've been joking lately, if you can count on Congress doing one thing, it's nothing. So in that sense, it is a somewhat bleak situation at the federal level. As you can imagine, none of those three options is politically feasible. It's not even clear that any of the three options has majority support within either chamber of Congress. So it is anybody's guess at this point how Congress will deal with that issue. Although I will give you some prognostications. Discussions are starting in both chambers about how to address that issue. However, as you can imagine, with Congress, there's more than a year before the Highway Trust Fund runs out of cash. They've got something like the debt ceiling in, like 18 days before the federal government can't borrow any more money, and about the same amount of time before the federal budget expires. So they're dealing with those issues. A year in Congress is like dog years, like 7 years in the real world. So in that sense, it's going to be a long time, I think, before Congress really buckles down and deals with those particular issues. However, there are some discussions starting. The new chair of the Highway and Transit Committee in the House, Bill Schuster from Pennsylvania, sounds very interested in dealing with this issue and is open to discussions about revenue rather than merely cutting funding. And he says all options are on the table. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out in the House. The chair of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, Barbara Boxer from California, is also engaged on this issue, and they're starting to have some conversations back and forth. However, they both sort of publicly stated that they're not sure that another general fund infusion of resources is feasible in the face of the current federal budget austerity that we're all seeing in the sequestration. They have other places they would put money, perhaps, if there were general fund resources available. Interestingly, in both chambers, those committee leaders and other folks who are very engaged on transportation are interested in Oregon's road use charge that passed the legislature this last session in SB 810. However, and everyone realizes that issue, that approach of charging a per mile fee as opposed to the gas tax as vehicles become more fuel efficient, is not really a short-term solution. It's not going to solve our 2015 problem that you see up there with highway funding falling off the charts. It's more likely, I think, that the federal government will allow Oregon and other states, the laboratories of democracy, as they talk about, to take the lead, to determine whether the system works, and then determine whether it should move forward. It took the feds 13 years after Oregon passed the first gas tax in 1919 before the federal government created a gas tax. So change comes slowly at the federal level. So my prognostication is that when we get a year from now and Congress is deeply engaged on trying to fix this issue with the Highway Trust Fund, they will simply punt past the election, because there is an election next November, about a month after the Highway Trust Fund, which should before MAP 21 expires, and around the time that MAP 21 or the Highway Trust Fund runs out of cash. And I don't think anybody really wants to go to voters having just cut transportation funding by a third. So it's more likely, I think, that they will probably punt past the election, find a little bit of money to put into the Highway Trust Fund that will shore it up for 6 months, and then let the next Congress deal with that. there has been some talk about some sort of grand bargain on the federal fiscal situation, including revenue for transportation, because as you can imagine, when we're transferring $55 billion of general fund revenue into the Highway Trust Fund, that is essentially reducing that money from going toward deficit reduction. So the Simpson-Bowles proposal, for example, which was the sort of grand bargain proposal that came out a couple years ago at the federal level, had a 15 cent per gallon gas tax increase that would go into transportation but would reduce the amount of deficit spending essentially for transportation. In fact, the last two gas tax increases have actually gone for deficit reduction. In 1991 and 1993, the gas tax was raised as part of those deficit reduction deals. However, with the current situation in Congress, I'm certainly not going to hold my breath for a grand bargain, because I would turn blue and then probably pass out before that happened. The implications for Oregon are pretty significant. Because ODOT State Highway Fund revenues now are currently fully dedicated going forward to debt service, maintaining highways, and agency operations costs, federal funds are the only source that we have projected for transportation projects going forward. So anything that we are going to build to preserve or improve the system would have to come from federal funds in our current revenue situation. If Congress does not provide revenue for the Highway Trust Fund, this chart shows what would happen after MAP 21 expires. Highway funding would be cut by about 25%. That would reduce Oregon's highway funding by $100, $125 million per year. At that magnitude of cuts, we would likely have to cut a pretty significant number of projects from the STIP or defer those into a later year, the STIP being the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. Although we have made some decently conservative assumptions about future revenue because we see the writing on the wall and recognize that federal funding may be stagnant or fall a little bit. Local governments would be hit hard. The local governments in Oregon receive about 25% to 30% of the highway funding that we get from the federal government. So that pays for a lot of capital construction projects and other projects that the local government, cities and counties in particular, undertake. On the transit side, the cuts would be even more severe. I don't have that chart up here because it's actually really difficult to calculate, but the mass transit account of the Highway Trust Fund faces a proportionately larger shortfall in revenue. So on the transit side, the cuts could be 40 to 45%. That would cause significant hardship for transit agencies that rely on federal funds for capital investments, and some of them rely on federal funds for operating funds, particularly in the rural areas. So some of those rural transit agencies would be particularly hard hit. So what's this all mean when it really comes down? Given the fiscal challenges within the Federal Highway Trust Fund, Oregon faces significant uncertainty about the future availability of federal transportation funding, and there is significant risk that funding will be cut significantly. This makes it extremely difficult for us as we're building a long-term capital program, the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. We're currently projecting out to 2018, and yet we don't have federal funding in any way secure beyond 2015. So it makes it very difficult for us as we create those long-term capital programs, and as we start looking at projects, particularly major projects, start planning a project today, we have no idea whether federal funding will be available, say, 5 years from now when that project is ready to go to construction. In the long term, the Federal Highway Trust Fund has a very high reliance on the gas tax. So you saw earlier the State Highway Fund has that three-legged stool of vehicle and driver fees, the weight mile tax, and the gas tax, or the fuel tax. At the federal level, it's about 85 to 90% fuels tax, and about 70% of that is just the gas tax. There's also the diesel tax going into the Federal Highway Trust Fund. But as a result, as vehicles become more fuel efficient, it's likely that the federal funding will be hit even harder than we might see at the state level because of our more secure and multi-leveled or multi-layered revenue structure. You know, in general, what we've seen over the last few decades is that federal infrastructure spending as a portion of the economy and as a portion of the federal budget has been falling over time. And I don't think any pundit would tell you that there's any reason to expect that trend to reverse, especially as we've now seen federal, essentially, budget austerity kick in and the costs of paying for retirement and health care programs will grow over time. So I think it's quite likely that federal transportation funding will remain stagnant at best, and that the federal government will, in the long term, reduce its role in providing the significant funding that has helped us create an efficient transportation system. In the long term, I think that responsibility will likely shift from the federal government more towards states and local governments as the federal government reduces its role in that area.
Any questions?
Pretty cheery guy.
Yeah, makes you happy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's the pits being a vice chair.
I know. I can't handle the pressure.
I do have a question. It doesn't have to do, I know you were addressing the federal issue, but I did bring up the question before about electric cars, hybrids, and, you know, the higher gas mileage eating in. Has anybody ever worked up a tax per mile, what it cost like in 1990 versus the tax per mile now? I think that's would be pretty revealing as to the dilemma that we have statewide with the higher gas mileage vehicles coming online.
Yeah, Senator Girard, I have not seen that specific analysis done, but I have seen some interesting analysis that looks at how the highway trust or how the federal gas tax has been impacted by both increasing fuel efficiency and inflation adjustment, where the amount, say if you have it with a new vehicle versus an older vehicle, the amount you're paying per mile in inflation-adjusted terms has dropped significantly. I looked at some numbers the other day that showed that new vehicles in 2013 are about 20 to 25% more fuel efficient than new vehicles purchased in 2007, which was actually the curve started bending upward in 2004 when gas prices went up. So the new vehicles today are significantly more fuel efficient than what we saw in 2004, and that trend, as those vehicles are replaced then, will have a long-term, a slow, but a long-term impact that's pretty substantial.
Well, but I think if you look at the trend from 1990 to now, you know, we're over the 20-year span, where 93 or 95, when it's both state and feds, it shows the problem that we're having. It also helps sell raising revenue if you, I think it would be a sales point.
Okay. I guess I have a question.
Go right ahead.
So with this deficit that you're saying is possible because of the issues at the national level, what kind of a increase are we looking at to maintain that level, like in cents per gallon? Have you looked at that?
Yes, Senator Chair Girard, Vice Chair Thompson, in order to maintain federal highway funding at the current level would require a gas tax increase of 8 to 10 cents per gallon in the federal gas tax to avoid a cut.
Yeah, at the federal level. But if you're saying the feds aren't going to do anything, what are we looking at in Oregon to maintain the level we're at now? Is that the same number? Are you talking about Oregon? Or are you talking at the federal level?
Yeah, Senator Girard, Vice Chair Thompson, I'm talking about the federal government. I have not done any calculations like that or don't know what discussions might be underway to look at that.
Because obviously we can't do anything about the feds, but we can do something about the state. And I think we have a responsibility to our highway system and commerce to make sure that everything functions as well as we can. And we haven't, you know, money for new projects. As all this extra capacity comes on, you really have to look at areas that you need new projects, or commerce is going to come to a grinding halt here.
So, Mr. Chair, I'll try to do just a kind of a quick summary of what we've been talking about. This is what we affectionately call the mountain chart, and you've seen this one before. It looks backwards and forward at the major funding sources that we have from a bonding standpoint, the STIP standpoint that Travis just talked about, and what's not on here is the state side. So I just want to talk about those three things. What Travis Brower just talked about is the STIP piece underneath there, the blue funding piece is really the bread and butter, the foundational piece of our capital program. It funds all our bridge work. It funds our paving work. It funds those smaller projects we just talked about in Sisters and Lincoln City. It's really the foundation of our transportation program. many of the projects that I talked about, the major projects, are part of those bonded projects there in the different OTIA 3 projects, the Jobs and Transportation Act, maybe the stimulus money, or the even back to the OTIA 1 and 2 projects. Those are the ones that may gather the headlines or the bigger projects you see out there. Those are from one-time money, bonded money, as you saw in David Kavanaugh's presentation, where that bonding money is taking more and more of our revenue up. So as you look at kind of the federal side, the ongoing federal side, which is that STIP blue piece underneath, the one-time bonded money, which is in the kind of the multicolor mountain part of this chart, and then the third leg is the state funding that Mr. Kavanaugh talked about. That state funding is really what we use to fund the day-to-day operation of the system. Largely our maintenance funds come out of that, our DMV funds, the day-to-day operations that cities and counties and ODOT uses to run the system every day comes out of that state, the state portion of our funds. As our state funds go down, we can't take those, there's not enough funds to go around to operate the system and then move into a capital program. And so as Travis just talked about, our capital program is limited more and more just to those federal funds. And as those federal funds go down, what it means is our capital program goes down, especially in those critical kind of bread and butter pieces. As you look to taking Travis's projections, what that does to different parts of our system, and again, I've used these slides before, but shows on out to clear out to 2060, so way out in the future, what happens to our bridge conditions. In the short term, you see our bridge conditions go up because we've made a significant strategic investment in the OTIA 3 bridge program, addressing roughly one-fifth of the problem. You see some of the numbers of our overall bridge numbers go up. But over the long term, we don't have the sustainable amount of funding to keep our bridge conditions where we need to keep our bridge conditions based on what we're seeing happen or not happening in Congress. Similarly, on the pavement conditions, a little shorter time period, but the same type of impact happens to the condition of our pavements as those, again, bread and butter pieces of our STIP federal program go down over that time period. So just, again, try to summarize those things in those three categories that I think about: state funds that operate the system, federal funds to do bread and butter construction projects in our system, and then the one-time bonded funds that we have for the JTA and the OTIA projects out there, thinking about the revenue matching to where those expenditure of those revenues go to. So just a quick summary.
Looks kind of bleak.
Yeah, kind of walking you through where we're at. Good.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Finishes our agenda, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else we want to hear from?
We could solicit input from the audience if you
want. Is there anybody that wishes to give any more testimony? If not, we stand adjourned.